Radio Mises avsnitt 80. Denna gång med ytterligare en alldeles förträfflig intervju. För den som inte flodde från titeln har vi alltså intervjuat Walter Block, som väl kanske är en av de tyngsta libertarianska teoretikerna. Men först, hej Klaus.
Tjena Hans.
Nu har vi ju redan spelat in den här intervjun, men vi kanske ska säga någonting på svenska först också. Det blir ju rakt in i hetluften när vi slår på sen. Och Walter är ju fruktansvärt rolig, det går ju inte att förneka.
Man får inte ha så ömma tår heller när man har med Walter att göra.
Nej, han säger precis vad han tycker på precis vilket sätt han tycker. Walter Block är ju en av eleverna till Murray Rothbard. Kanske den mest, vad ska man säga, mest produktiva eleven har haft. Inte riktigt lika produktiv som Murray Rothbard, men det kan väl ingen i världshistorien vara.
Nej, han har ju skrivit mycket om det här med vägarna. Vem som ska bygga vägarna, det har varit ett av hans liksom, favoritämnen.
Privatizing Roads and Highways, tror jag boken heter.
Men vi pratar inte så mycket om vägar just.
Det känns avverkat.
Ja.
Men han har skrivit någonstans i storleksordningen 500 vetenskapliga artiklar, ett antal böcker och så vidare. Nej, vi började ju prata mer om hans serie Defending the Undefendable, som är väl den hans mer kontroversiella sak, där han försöker påpeka att allting som inte bryter mot icke-aggressionsprincipen går principiellt att försvara, även om man kanske inte tycker om det. Så han drar upp allsköns konstiga karaktärer som han tycker att det går att försvara. Som folk vanligtvis inte tycker så mycket om, men det är väl just det poängen han försöker föra fram.
Min favorit var försvaret av dvärgkastare.
Ja, just det. Försvaret av dvärgkastaren. Ja, han är inne på sin tredje upplaga av boken. Han gjorde ju en på 70-talet, och sen för några år sedan så gjorde han en Defending the Undefendable version 2, och nu ska han tydligen göra en version 3 också. Ta fram flera konstiga typer som man kan, i teorin, bör kunna försvara, även om man inte tycker att deras verksamhet är så trevlig.
Och det här är också en ganska viktig idé, det här att kunna försvara sånt som man inte... Alltså, bara för att man försvarar någonting juridiskt, en människas rätt att göra någonting som man kanske inte gillar, så betyder inte det att man förespråkar det här. Och det här är ju en sak som ibland är lite svår att hålla. Det är två idéer som är lite svåra att hålla i huvudet samtidigt.
Ja, alla vill ju förbjuda det de inte tycker om. Och det är väl kanske det som Block försöker motarbeta här. Att man kan inte förbjuda saker bara för att man inte tycker om dem. Skadar de inte någon annan så ska de nog tillåtas.
Ja, vi brukar inte ägna oss åt såna här knark och sex och rock'n'roll-frågor här på Mises.se.
Nej, inte vår specialitet.
Givetvis ska människor få syssla med sånt också, även om det inte är liksom några av de viktigaste ämnena i mitt liv direkt.
Nej, precis. Vi tänker inte förbjuda folk från att ägna sig åt vad de nu vill ägna sig åt. Nåväl, Murray Rothbard nämns ju i förbifarten. Vi skulle nästan vilja prata mer om det, men det hann vi inte. Men när Walter Block refererar bara till Murray, så är det självklart Murray Rothbard han åsyftar. Det var väl kanske det vi ville säga bara innan vi springer rakt in i det hela. Vi kanske ska nämna att vi kommer in på Walter Blocks mest kontroversiella ståndpunkt, som var en ståndpunkt som det bråkats i libertarianska kretsar, huruvida man kan sälja sig själv till slaveri. Det är väl en poäng som har i princip noll praktisk relevans i dagsläget, utan det är ju mer en principfråga, testande av principerna. Däremot är det ganska intressant att diskutera den typen av principer och var gränsen för mänskliga viljan går och så vidare.
Jo, och därmed så får vi väl se det här som våran triggervarning. Man ska ha sånt nu för tiden.
Det är viktigt med triggervarningen.
Vissa lyssnare, inte de liksom hårt prövade lyssnarna som varit med ett tag, men nya lyssnare kan kanske känna sig lite triggade av det här avsnittet.
Lite kränkta om de har otur, ja. Det kan vi tyvärr inte göra så mycket åt. Och med det så får vi väl säga, ja, mycket nöje, och här är Walter Block. Joining us today is yet another libertarian heavyweight. He is famous for several radical books. Perhaps the one most people have heard about is Defending the Undefendable. He's a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, and a professor in economics. Of course, none other than Mr. Walter Block. Hello, Walter.
I didn't like that heavyweight. I'm trying to lose weight.
Oh, I'm sorry, Walter. Didn't know that.
I'll forgive you.
Okay, thank you. So,
I think you look good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, that's Klaus for those who didn't guess. Always Klaus. So, Walter, you've written articles about almost everything under the sun. We thought we'd pick out a few topics from things you've written about and see what if you can elaborate a bit.
Okay, sounds good.
It's mandatory that we start with Defending the Undefendable. For those who haven't read it, it's a book where you use sort of libertarian views to defend things people usually don't think you can actually defend. How come you wrote that book? I mean, it's a long time ago, but how come you decided to write it?
Well, actually, Defending the Undefendable 1, I wrote in 1976, and Defending the Undefendable 2, I wrote in, I can't find out the date. Here it is, 2013. So there are really two Defending the Undefendables.
There's a sequel now. I didn't know that. How could I miss that?
Well, I'm glad that I'm able to bring this up. And I'm now working on Defending the Undefendable 3. So there'll be three one of these days. How did I get to write number one? I was doing my PhD dissertation at Columbia University. And I was writing it on rent control. And rent control is, something non-libertarian. And I was working away. But most of what I was doing was not the theoretical stuff that I enjoy, but rather econometric studies, statistics, and evidence and stuff like that. And I'm more theoretical than I am empirical. And I was working away, and it was hard because I wasn't really that interested in it, but I had to finish it. I didn't want to go to Vietnam and shoot people and have them shoot at me. So I just kept working at it. And the way I motivated myself, I said, well, if I just do this little bit, I promise I'll take one whole day off from the dissertation and write whatever I want. So I'd write about, the pimp or blackmail or something like that. And then I'd get back to the dissertation. And then I'd promise myself that if I did just this much more on the dissertation, I could have one more day to myself and do whatever I wanted. And by the time I finished the dissertation, I had about 30 articles. Let me read the articles. These are the chapters in the book. And under sex, I had the prostitute, the pimp, and the male chauvinist pig. Before I read it, let me just explain what this book is about. It's called Defending the Undefendable. And I'm a libertarian, so I believe in the non-aggression principle and property rights based on homesteading and legitimate title transfers that are voluntary, such as trade and barter and lending and borrowing and stuff like that. And I note that there are lots of people and occupations that are hated by everyone or virtually everyone or are prohibited by law and yet do not violate the non-aggression principle. Now, according to libertarianism, the only laws that there should be a law against murder, a law against theft, a law against, rape, a law against things like that, kidnapping. But that's it. No more laws against anything else. And yet there are laws about, the first three, the prostitute, the pimp, and the male chauvinist pig, are either prohibited by law or hated by everyone. And since they don't violate any libertarian principles, I defended them. And not only did I defend them, but I defended them as heroic. Look, right now it is legal. Klaus is wearing a white shirt, Hans is wearing a green shirt, and I'm wearing a blue shirt. And right now, this is all legal. But suppose the government, in its infinite wisdom, decided that white, green, and blue shirts are no good. And anyone wearing them has to go to jail because you're violating whatever. Well, if we insisted on wearing them, then we would be heroic. I would defend us for wearing shirts. Now, happily, nobody hates people who wear shirts in white, green, or blue. And there are no laws against it as far as I know, although maybe in some countries, who knows. So they're not in my book. But if the law ever were, or if people started hating white, green, and blue, then I would put them in my book. Okay, so with that background, I'm now going to read the chapters in Defending 1 and 2. And as you read them, people in your listening audience should ask themselves, is it either hated by everyone or everyone who counts, like the New York Times or feminists or whoever, Black Lives Matter people, they're the ones who count, or is it illegal? And if it is, then it belongs in my book, and then I'm going to defend it. Okay, so under sex, I've got the prostitute, the pimp, and the male chauvinist pig, medical, the drug pusher, and the drug addict. Under free speech, the blackmailer, slanderer, libeler, denier of academic freedom, advertiser, person who yells far in a crowded theater. Under outlaw, the gypsy cab driver, the ticket scalper, and the dishonest cop. I'll have to explain that one. Under financial, the non-government counterfeiter, the miser, inheritor, moneylender, non-contributor to charity. Again, as I read these, think, are they illegal or cordially hated by, you know, all good people, that is non-libertarians. Under business and trade, the curmudgeon, the slumlord, the ghetto merchant, the speculator, importer, middleman, and profiteer, a favorite of mine, profits. Under ecology, the strip miner, the litterer on government property, that is, and the waste maker, one who wastes resources. And under labor, the fat capitalist pig employer, the scab, the rate buster, and the employer of child labor. So that's the listing here. And now I must read the listing in this book.
Oh, by all means.
Which, as you'll see, it's all new characters. There's no overlap, or if there is, I made a mistake because I'm trying to do new characters each book, and in defending three, there'll be a whole host of about 30 new characters. Okay, so in this book, Defending the Undefendable 2, under trade, the multinational enterpriser, the smuggler, the British Petroleum, the one that had the oil spill, nuclear energy, the corporate raider, under labor, the hatchet man who fires people, the home worker who works at home, the picket line crosser, all unions hate that, the automator, the person who puts in automation, under medical, the person who smokes, the organ merchant, human organ merchant, the one who sells used kidneys, the breast milk substitute purveyor, under sex, topless in public, which is illegal for women anyway, polygamous marriage. Now we have gay marriage. What about polygamous marriage? The sexist under discriminators, the sexist, the peeping Tom, the person who violates privacy, because I don't believe that there are any privacy rights, the ageist, the person who discriminates against old people, the homophobe, person who discriminates against gay people, the stereotyper. Under business, the war toy manufacturer, the colorizer, the person who colorizes old black and white movies. Don't ask. This is hated. Not sure why. The baby seller, the heritage building destroyer, and under politically incorrect, the bad Samaritan, the duelist, the person who engages in a duel, the executioner, a defensive death penalty, the dwarf thrower, that is people who throw dwarfs, and the intellectual property denier. So I'm against intellectual property. Now, I've given like 60 topics, and we can be here all night.
I'm going to have to start. Are you seriously saying you can defend all these positions? I mean, some of them are obvious to me, but I mean, the baby seller, the corrupt cop, you can actually defend these?
Yes, yes.
Maybe we should just pick out those two because they seem so utterly undefendable to me.
I want to add the dwarf thrower in there.
Oh, okay. Right, the dwarf thrower as well.
Let's have those three. We can start with those three and maybe get into more or whatever. Okay, yep. So the first one is the baby seller. Okay. I and my wife, or I and my girlfriend, we have a baby. And we have 20 kids. And you, Hans, or you, Claus, have been unable to have a kid. You've tried and tried. Your wife or your girlfriend is unable to conceive. And you really want a baby, and I've got 20. And I say, okay, look, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you one, rather I'll sell you one, because I'm poor and you're rich, or even if I'm not poor, you know, for $100,000, you can have this baby. Now, you have to take the baby. I mean, if there were no price, you know, it would be just an adoption. I'm putting up a baby right for adoption, and you're adopting a baby. And no one would quarrel with that. But for some reason, when it's done for money, it becomes bad. Why? I mean, look, suppose you engage in voluntary sex with a woman. an adult woman, and she agrees. It's voluntary consenting adults, and there's no problem. But if somehow you pay her for that, all of a sudden this becomes a problem. Well, for many people, but not for libertarians. So all I'm saying is that it's perfectly legal to adopt a baby. And what's wrong with putting a price on it? I mean, if the thing is wrong, it's wrong whether there's a price or not. And if the thing is right or legitimate, then it's legitimate whether there's a price or not. It doesn't matter. So I'm defending baby selling. I know it sounds provocative, and like you're going to kill the baby. No, 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 you're not going to kill the baby. If you killed the baby, you'd be a murderer. But you're going to take care of the baby. And as you would if it was an adoption for no money. But now you just pay me $10,000 or whatever it is, and that doesn't make it illegitimate. So that would be...
The interesting thing, I mean, adoption usually goes the other way. You have to sort of pay an agency to adopt. They do all the work. And it's okay to pay the agency for the work they do, but it's not okay to pay whoever is giving up the child. But so what you're saying is something is either moral or not moral, and if it is moral, then it doesn't matter if money is involved, and if it's immoral, it doesn't matter either, because then it's always immoral.
Well, not so much immoral. See, for libertarians, we're not really concerned that much with morality. We're concerned with, does it violate rights? And right. An adoption does not violate rights. I mean, look, there are things that are immoral that I, as a libertarian, don't really like. Prostitution. Look, I have a daughter. I wouldn't want her to be a prostitute. I think it's immoral. But as a libertarian, the only question I can ask and answer is, should it be illegal? And since it does not violate rights, it should be legal, even though I personally don't like it. I don't go to prostitutes. I don't want my daughter to be a prostitute. I think it would be better. We'd have a better world if no one ever prostituted themselves, and that we should have a relationship without money. But just because money changes hands doesn't make it illegal, although it does make it illegal for non-libertarians. But for libertarians, it doesn't. So here we have an adoption, and everyone says adoptions are fine. And by the way, the agency I cover under middlemen, that's an entirely different issue. I mean, you know, I try to take one thing at a time, and here we're just talking about baby adoption for money. And then the middleman is somebody who is in the middle between a buyer and a seller, an agent, you know, like you want to buy a house. So you come to me as a middleman or something like that, or a middleman buys from the manufacturer and sells to the retailer. I mean, that's an entirely different issue. And we libertarians don't think there's anything per se wrong with being a middleman because, you know, middleman engages in voluntary trade with the manufacturer and the retailer. He's like a wholesaler, a middleman. Fine. Okay, so we've now covered the baby seller?
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. Now, what was the other one before the dwarf?
The corrupt policeman.
Ah, the corrupt policeman. Okay. Yeah. The corrupt policeman. Okay. So let's get back to prostitution. And the cop sees a prostitute. And if he were not corrupt, what he'd do is arrest her, put her in jail. Yep. If he's corrupt, he will be open to a bribe or an extortion. He could say to her, look, lady prostitute, I'm now going to put you in jail. However, I'm corrupt. Give me $100 and I won't put you in jail. Well, who would we rather have? An honest cop who puts her in jail or a corrupt cop who charges $100? And let's say that she values her freedom more than $100. So she's willing to pay $100 to stay out of jail. Or another form of corruption is that he's open to a bribe. So he says, okay, lady, you're under arrest. And she says, tut, 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 not so fast. I'll give you $50 or I'll give you sexual services or whatever it is that she's going to offer him. Don't arrest me. And he says, okay, well, he's corrupt, but I prefer him to an honest cop. In other words, we only want honest cops when the law is just. When there's
okay.
Or a murder or a theft or, you know, something bad, and now the cop stops it and we don't want the cop to let the criminal go because he's a real criminal. But here, there's a victimless criminal, namely a non-criminal. And we want corruption. Namely, we want the cop not to uphold the law because it's an unjust law.
So for the one in 10,000 laws that is just, we would like to have, you know, good cops. And for the rest of the 9,999 laws, we would like to have corrupt cops.
Unfortunately, I have to agree with your rough percentage. I mean, most laws are unjust. I mentioned, you know, five or six on the fingers of one or two hands, you know, murder, rape, theft, kidnapping, fraud, whatever. And that's about it. oh, I could come up with maybe some more if we thought about it. But, you know, there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of laws, none of them like this, and only these kinds are just. I mean, like, take the Nazi concentration camp. We want corrupt concentration camp guards who let people free.
Yeah, right? Yeah, of course. Well,
We don't want honest concentration camp guards who kill innocent people. So we want corruption. We want an undermining of law when the law is unjust. We only want honesty when the law is just. And as Klaus says quite accurately, so few laws are just. So we want a lot of corrupt cops.
This is perhaps a philosophical question, but the whole concept of law is sort of requires that people follow them. Otherwise, nobody cares about them. Isn't it a problem if people... I mean, we know there are a lot of laws that aren't just, but if people just start randomly breaking laws, isn't that a problem?
Yes, I don't want them to randomly start breaking laws. I want them to break laws that are wrong from a libertarian point of view, not randomly. I mean, you know, we don't want them to break the law against rape or murder because we think that the law against rape or murder or theft is a legitimate law, and we don't want people to break those. We don't want them to break them randomly. We want them to break them purposefully, namely illegitimate laws. Like take runaway slavery. I mean, slavery was the law until 1865 in the U.S., and sometimes slaves escaped. And the law was to bring them back. Well, we want people to break that law because slavery is unjust. So there's nothing wrong with breaking an unjust law. There's something wrong with breaking a just law. And for libertarians, we're not logical, legal positivists. We don't think that just because it's a law, it's right. Some laws are legitimate and other laws are not legitimate. And we want illegitimate laws broken. Yes, this undermines respect for law. Well, respect for law should be undermined because most laws, as Klaus says, quite accurately, are illegitimate. So we want to have disrespect for law, illegitimate law. Not all law, but illegitimate law. And only libertarians, well, maybe some other people see it too, but libertarians quintessentially see that distinction, a very important distinction.
Isn't it interesting when you look at the laws that the state is most concerned with? It is not the fact that people get raped or beaten up or murdered, but it's crimes against arbitrariness, against the state, actually. Those are the worst crimes.
The worst law from their point of view is the tax law. They're very, very insistent that you not break the tax law, namely you not refuse to pay your taxes. But the tax law is unjust because, you know, we didn't agree to be paid. I'm not only a libertarian, but I'm an anarcho-libertarian. I don't believe that any government is just. And therefore, when they tax us, this is no difference between somebody coming with a gun and saying, give me money or I'll shoot you. Well, that's what the government does. So I would say Klaus is again right that what they really are concerned about is not so much murder and rape, although they do try to stop that, but what they're really concerned about is the tax law. Cigarettes, like there was this guy in Staten Island, New York, who was arrested for selling cigarettes that were loose, namely not in a pack. Why? Because he didn't pay taxes on it.
All right.
He ended up being killed, but to be fair to the cops, he wasn't killed because of selling cigarettes. He was Lucy's, it's called. He was killed for resisting arrest, which is a very different issue.
Now, that's a crime too. It's a crime to resist arrest of.
Right. And he was right in resisting arrest because he was being arrested for a wrong thing, namely selling cigarettes. But still, he was killed for resisting arrest, not for selling cigarettes. Because if he would have said, look, okay, you caught me. I sold cigarettes. I'm sorry. Put my hands here. You can put handcuffs on me. They wouldn't have killed him. I mean, they're not that bad. I doubt they would have killed him if he would have come along peaceably. The reason they killed him is he was resisting arrest, to be fair to the government cops. I mean, we have to be accurate and be fair, even though we oppose government and government cops.
Yeah.
Klaus, did you want to The throwing of dwarves. We have to do that one as well, right?
Yeah, a quick one on that.
Let's do that. Well, dwarves are adults. We're not talking about children now. Dwarves are small people who are, you know, 3 feet tall or whatever, 2 feet tall or whatever it is. And
I think it's called vertically challenged these days.
Ah, sorry. I should have offered a trigger warning because I might be saying something that might possibly hurt someone's feelings or disagree something I say. Yes, vertically challenged. I apologize. How can I be so cruel as to use politically incorrect language? Mea culpa. Okay. So anyway, these dwarfs... people take them and throw them. And then they have like a shot put contest to see who could throw the dwarf the furthest, or to see who could throw a dwarf through a basketball net, or to see throwing a dwarf at a bunch of bowling pins and see how many bowling pins get knocked over. There are various themes and variations on this. And somehow this is seen as cruel and unusual or despicable. Now, I find it actually cruel and unusual and despicable. I wouldn't want to be involved in throwing a dwarf. On the other hand, this is consenting adults. I mean, I don't like this behavior. And as a libertarian, I'm not committed to liking it. I'm only committed to defending the legality of it. Namely, if you prohibit it, you're prohibiting a voluntary contract between consenting adults. And the dwarf and the dwarf thrower have every right to make a contract with each other. And that would be the burden of that chapter, to defend it on the ground, not because it's likable or nice. I don't think it's likable or nice, but it should be legal. And anyone who prohibits this by law is violating rights.
A question. I think you've written some controversial things about this. Can you actually make a legal contract if you, one of the parties, will get hurt or even killed by this contract? Is that legal? Should it be legal?
Well, I don't know if it is legal, but it should be legal. Sure. I mean,
you can contract away your life.
Well, in boxing, I'm a professional boxer and I want to box one of you guys. And for the middleweight title, although I'm a heavyweight, so I can't get into the middleweight. You dirty rat calling me a heavyweight. I'll get you for that. No, I'm kidding.
I'm small. Don't hit me too hard.
I lost the picture of Klaus.
Oh, that's okay.
We have the sound.
He's so pretty. I've got to see him. Okay, I can see both pictures now. So we enter into a boxing match, and one of us punches the other guy very hard and kills him. Is the guy a murderer? No. When I punch you in the nose, you can't accuse me of assault and battery because you've agreed to be punched and punch above the belt and no biting ears and, you know, other things like that. But surely we can make a contract where a person can be harmed. I mean, the whole point of boxing is to harm the other guy. The aim, I think, of most boxers is not to kill the guy, but, you know, knock him down or to at least win the bout. But sometimes, look, it's dangerous to be hit in the head. It's even worse than American football, where some people get brain concussions. Here, you're trying to punch him. I no longer see myself in the picture.
Your camera died.
I don't know. I don't need to see myself as much as you guys. So
if you click your camera button on and off, it may come back.
Somehow. There I am. Okay.
Yeah.
It is legitimate to have a contract where one or both parties are hurt. Even the winner of a boxing match gets hurt. I mean, he gets punched a little bit, even though he won. The more interesting question is, and here is very divisive among libertarians, is it legitimate to have a voluntary slave contract where I sell myself into slavery?
Now, that was your and Murray's big point of contention, right?
Murray and I disagree on this. And let me just say a word about Murray and disagreement. Murray was my mentor, my hero, my friend, my guru, my teacher. I love Murray. I love Murray. Murray is magnificent. And not only is he magnificent, but he's a genius in so many, many areas, economics, politics, philosophy, law, whatever. But personally, I mean, the way he reacts to younger people, followers of his who disagree with him, is a lesson for us all. For example, Murray used to ground libertarianism on the base of natural law and natural rights. Along comes Hans Hoppe, who was a young pup when he came to the U.S. and met Murray. Murray was maybe 50. Hans was, I don't know, 22, 25. And Hans had a better defense of libertarianism called the argument from argument. I'm not going to go into
the argumentation ethics. Yeah.
Argumentation ethics, another way of characterizing it. Now, Murray was the leader of the group, and Hans was just some young kid. How did Murray react to this? Murray said, Hans is right. Not that I'm giving up on natural law and natural rights, but Hans's argumentation ethics is a better way of doing it. Now, he never did that with me with voluntary slavery. He was convinced that I was wrong and he was right, but he never cut me off either. He never said, oh, Block, you disagree with me, you're out. I want nothing to do with you, or, you know, anything like that, where a lot of leaders like Ayn Rand would do that to a follower who disagreed with her on just about anything, practically. So Murray and I disagree, and I've had other disagreements with Murray on this, and I've never felt the slightest compunction about disagreeing with Murray on anything, because Murray was a gentleman. Murray was a decent guy. Murray realized that we're dealing with complicated issues, and sometimes people disagree, but our hearts are in the right place. We're just trying to interpret libertarianism to the best we can. Okay, so let's get back into this case after my introduction to this sort of a thing. Okay, so the situation is that Klaus has long wanted me to be his slave, and Klaus is very rich. And my son, who I love dearly, has a horrible disease, God forbid, and it'll cost $5 million to cure him. I don't have $5 million. So I go to Klaus and I say, hey, Klaus, you've long wanted me to be your slave. Give me $5 million. I'll give it to my son's doctors. It'll save my son's life, and I'll be your slave. And both of us gain, Klaus and I will gain. I will gain because I value my son's life more than my freedom. Klaus will gain because he values my servitude to him more than the $5 million he has to give me that I give to my son's doctors. So it's a win-win situation, as in every case of at least ex ante. Like I talked about shirts before, we all bought a shirt, blue, white, and green. We paid $30 for the shirt. At the time we purchased it, we valued the shirt at more than $30, otherwise we wouldn't have bought it. And the guy who sold us these shirts valued it at less than $30. Otherwise, he wouldn't have sold it to us. And so there was mutual gain. Well, there's mutual gain in buying shirts, and there's mutual gain in selling yourself into slavery, in the ex ante sense of anticipation. Right.
Let me shoot a question here. Are you arguing for slavery or indentured servitude? I mean, can Klaus essentially give up his rights, his libertarian rights, or can you only force him to do things that are within the law, so to speak?
Well, it depends on the contract. Now, indentured servitude was 6 years, and the master couldn't whip the servant, and he couldn't kill him. Here, I'm talking about something different, because now Klaus can kill me, or he can torture me. Well, it depends upon what the contract says, whether he can kill me or how many whippings he can give me per day. But suppose that the deal is that not only can he kill me, but he can torture me to death. Okay, so now he's busy whipping me, and I yell, stop, stop whipping me, Klaus, you're a dirty rat, you're whipping me. And Hans, you're a cop, and I say, hey, Hans, do your duty, get Klaus to stop. Klaus is whipping me, and if he keeps whipping me, he's going to kill me, and it's torture. And my view is that I would be in the wrong, and you would be in the wrong, Hans, if you stop Klaus from whipping me, because he owns me. He owns me as a slave. Now, I have to tell you about, do you know about my problem with the New York Times and slavery?
No, we don't know about that problem.
Let me tell you about that, because it's on slavery. What happened is I was interviewing with the New York Times about libertarianism, and they just weren't getting the non-aggression principle. So finally I took a very radical example. I said, look, the only thing wrong with slavery was that it was coercive.
That's what is wrong with slavery.
That's why slavery is despicable, because it violated the libertarian non-aggression principle. So I said, look, suppose we had a system where you pick cotton. Would that be bad or evil? No. How about eating gruel? No. How about living in a little shack? No. How about even whipping? No, because sadomasochists whip each other. The only problem with slavery is that you couldn't quit and you were forced into it in the first place. And then I said, suppose we had this other system where you had to pick cotton and then eat gruel and do this and get whipped, but it was voluntary. That wouldn't be so bad. Actually, that would be okay. And then the New York Times quoted me as saying that actual slavery was okay.
All right.
Can you imagine?
New York Times.
Yeah. I can imagine. I can imagine.
I'm a hypothetical in there. So anyway, I'm now giving another interview where I mentioned slavery, because slavery is a very radical way of making the libertarian point. And the point is that I made a deal with Klaus, my slave owner, and it's not indentured servitude, because Klaus can do a lot more to me than anyone that could ever do to any indentured servitude. And also, it's for the rest of my life. So I defended this. Now, Murray says, no, no, no. Because you can't alienate the will. And that's true. I agree with Murray. You can't alienate the will. But my response is, will schmill. I'm not interested in the will. I'm only interested in whether an honest cop, Hans, I'm making you an honest cop, okay, should stop Klaus from whipping me. Namely, I'm selling my body, not my will. And my view is that, yeah, I can't sell my will, but I don't care about the will. I care about the body. Can I sell my body? And my view is, if you can't sell it, you don't really own it. And if you really own it, you can sell it. So I think Murray was wrong, with all due respect, on this issue.
It becomes almost a metaphysical question. Can you separate the will from the body, or is it a unity which you cannot sell?
Well, I don't know about that metaphysical thing. All I know about is that when I cry to you, Hans, for help, you're the honest cop, are you supposed to be helping me and stopping Klaus? And I say no.
But you, okay, yeah.
And it's interesting, because the government has taken upon itself to guarantee that people keep contracts between each other.
Well,
but not this type of contract.
Well, no, I don't think that, you know, they would say this contract is not in the national interest, or not a good contract. And look, there are a lot of contracts that the government will not uphold, like if I sell you some heroin. And now you renege on paying me for it, and I take you to court. You know, they're not going to put me in jail.
Yeah, probably.
So the government doesn't uphold all contracts.
That's true.
And now look, there are certain contracts that I think shouldn't be upheld. For example, if I make a contract with you, Klaus, go kill Hans, and I'll pay you money to kill Hans. That's an invalid contract. But I can sell myself.
You can sell yourself, but not anyone else, of course.
Not anyone else. I can't sell anyone else. A murder contract, a hit contract, is an illegitimate contract, and that shouldn't be upheld. It's sort of like I'm not a full free speech advocate. I'm not an absolutist on free speech, because there are certain sentences that is illegitimate to say. For example, give me money or I'll shoot you. That's a threat. And libertarianism opposed not only the initiation of violence, but a threat to initiate violence. So give me your money or I'll shoot your children, or, you know, anything like that. You shouldn't say, even though it's just a mere statement, it's a mere verbal exercise. But so libertarians, I think, if my view is correct, the libertarian should not be a absolutist on free speech. Rather, we should say you can speak about anything you damn well please, just don't make any threats. That's the one exception.
Are you allowed to, would you say you're allowed to carry out preemptive action against threats? Defend yourself against a threat?
Well, yes, but there's a continuum here. I mean, right now Hans is frowning at me. Stop laughing. Start frowning.
All right, I'll frown.
Look at that. That's a vicious frown. Now, suppose I shot him. Well, I'm the murderer.
Clearly.
That's a clear case. Look, this is a continuum problem. Let me illustrate this with statutory rape laws. We know that if you go to bed with a three-year-old girl, you're a criminal, even if she agreed, because we don't think that three-year-old girls or five-year-old girls are capable of agreeing to any such thing. On the other hand, if you go to bed with a 23 or a 25-year-old girl or woman and she agrees, you're not a statutory rapist. Well, what about 15 or 14 or 16? where do you draw the line? Where do you say, well, if they're younger than this, it's statutory rape. If they're not, it's not statutory rape. There's no one right answer. I mean, anywhere between, I don't know, 15 and 18, somewhere in there. I mean, 10 is too young and 20 is too old. But it's hard to pinpoint it. And what you have to do is based on the culture and the history. But if there's a culture in some far off land where you go to bed with a 7-year-old girl, I think that that's on the wrong side of the line. Okay, well, it's the same thing with threats. You know, if I right now I'm going to punch toward you guys. And if you shoot me, you're a murderer because, you know, what city are you in, Klaus?
I'm in Utah, Orem, Utah.
Okay, what city are you in, Hans?
I'm in Stockholm, Sweden.
Okay, I'm in New Orleans. And now I'm I'm offering a punch toward you. This is way over on one side of the line. And even apart from, well, even including the context, we're having a friendly discussion. I'm trying to illustrate a point. Even if you're in the same room with me, you would be very wrong if you use violence against me for threatening you by, you know, offering my fist at your face. On the other hand, notice I have a watch and I'm now pushing my fist at you and we're in a dark alley and the light glints off of my watch and you're not sure if it's a watch or a knife and you shoot me. Well, now you it's legitimate self-defense. Well, I've given, you know, the 4-year-old girl and the 24-year-old girl. And one is, you know, this theoretical punch and the other is in a dark alley where you're afraid it's a knife. Well, you need some sort of reasonable man kind of a thing to determine, and you need a private court to determine whether it's a real threat or not. So what I'm saying is libertarianism, you need judges. You can't deduce everything from the non-aggression principle and private property rights. You can deduce an awful lot, but you can't deduce everything from these basic principles, and you need courts and juries and reasonable men to know what the context is. Look, in a Shakespeare play, one guy shoots the other or sticks a knife in the other guy. It's just a play, for goodness sakes. Yeah, and if the actor takes a real gun and shoots the guy who's supposed to shoot him, that actor is crazy. I mean, that actor is a murderer. So you have to be sensitive to the context. You can't answer this question divorced from the context.
Right. I want to roll back a bit about we discussed things that could be that shouldn't be illegal, but we didn't like. There's it's called an anthology. There's a book, a collection of articles called "The Case for Discrimination," which you came out under your name, and I like the question of discrimination because everyone thinks discrimination is bad, but really we have to discriminate, don't we?
We have to discriminate. You know, every time we take an action, we're not doing some other action, so we're discriminating between the two. But you know what they mean by no discrimination is you shouldn't discriminate against blacks or gays or transgendered people or short people or tall people or old people. They keep adding new ones. They haven't added bald people yet. I don't know why. I'm hoping that one day – no, I'm kidding. Bald people. Look, the non-aggression principle says you can't initiate violence against people. But suppose I don't want to have anything to do with Claus. He's wearing a shirt and tie, and I hate shirts and ties, and I won't – and I put a sign up in my store saying, no one allowed in my store with a shirt and tie. And Claus likes shirts and ties, and he's not giving up his shirt and tie. And he can't come into my store. Now, this is not a protected, category. But one day it could be. Who knows what they'll be up to next. And yet it's my store. It's my property rights. And there's some sort of weirdness going on, because if I said no one with a shirt and tie can come to my house, that would be okay.
Yeah.
But or say a black person or a Jewish person can't come to my house, there would be no law against it. But if I say they can't come to my store, then there is a law against it. Why? I mean, what's this difference? I mean, if the thing is wrong, it should be wrong anywhere. Look, it's illegal to commit murder, rape, or theft in the home, and it's illegal to commit murder, rape, or theft in business. Why should discrimination be any different? And also, they have another thing, like, suppose I hate Chinese food. I just don't like Chinese food. And I never go to a Chinese restaurant. Nobody's going to come get me for violating. Or let's say black. Blacks are protected. I don't like soul food. I don't go to a black store. But if the black store won't allow me in, then they get in trouble. And now you have these cases with the gays where a gay couple, lesbian or homosexual, I forget which, went to a photographer, went to a baker, and went to a florist and said, come and officiate at our wedding. And the baker and the florist and the photographer said, you know, we're fundamentalist Christians. We wish you the best of luck, but we're not going to have anything to do with your wedding. We're not selling you our services or our goods. I think the baker got fined $130,000.
Yeah, it's something.
Which is,
he could have just said, no, sorry, we don't have time. And then nobody would have cared.
Oh, no, no, no. These people were activists. And they went purposely to a baker who they knew wouldn't serve them.
Oh, they wanted that answer.
They wanted that answer. I mean, they could have gone to a gay baker or to a, most bakers don't care. Most bakers, you know, a homosexual wedding, a polygamous wedding, they don't care. They're just more cakes for a polygamous wedding. Fine. They went to a baker that they knew or hoped would reject them so they could have a test case. Well, this is a violation of rights. They don't have a right to the – I mean, they're in a sense trying to make the baker a servitude. They violate free association. Look, the only problem with rape is that it violates the libertarian axiom of free association. The rape victim doesn't want to associate with the rapist. And the only problem with slavery is that the slave doesn't want to associate with the overseer and the master. We should have free association. The only association should be freely agreed upon by both parties or all parties, and no one should be able to force anyone to associate with them whether they want to or not. Now, a lot of people will say, well, but isn't this going to hurt blacks or poor people or someone like that? And there are two black economists, Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell, who have done more than any other two economists to show that these types of discrimination are really impotent to hurt the target group. For example, suppose we discriminate against women. We three are all employers, and we're not going to hire women because, you know, women are evil or whatever the reason is. And let's suppose that a man and a woman have equal productivity of $20 an hour. And because of our discrimination, the women's wage falls to $15 an hour. Because we discriminate, the demand curve for their women's services shifts to the left and now making less money than otherwise. So if someone hires a man at $20 an hour, whose productivity is $20 an hour, they make zero profits off of him, which is fine because in equilibrium there are no profits. But if you hire a woman, you make $5 an hour off of her because she's producing at the $20 an hour clip and you're only paying her $15, so you're making $5. Well, I know somebody else is going to say, hey, woman, I'll pay you $15.01. And someone else is going to go to the woman and say, hey, woman, I'll pay you $15.02. Come work for me. Where will this end? The wage will be back up to $20. So the reason that women are being paid less is not because of discrimination. It's because they have lower productivity. Now, you might say, well, isn't that sexist or racist or, well, sexist in this case?
No, no, not on this show. We won't say that, but some people might.
Well, some people might say it, but not on this show. This is a friendly libertarian group.
We're very, very tolerant here.
Okay, thank you. Well, look, in the 18th and the 17th century, women did have lower productivity because they're less strong than men on average. Look, there are some women shot putters that are way stronger than all three of us put together. But on average, men are stronger than women. And in the 19th century and 18th century, a lot of jobs needed physical strength. Like the way we'd cut down trees would be by sawing the trees, and the way we dig a hole would be with a pick and shovel. But nowadays, it's virtually all mechanically oriented. So why are women still less productive than men? Well, because we have this thing in economics called opportunity costs or alternative costs. Whenever you do anything, you do it at the cost of doing something else less well. The examples I like to use are Usain Bolt, who is the fastest man on the planet right now. His time for the 100 meters is 9.5, which is, you know, just amazing. But I'll bet you he's not a good cellist.
No, probably not.
And on the other hand, Yo-Yo Ma, the best cellist, is probably his time in the 100 meters is probably not that good. Why? Because in order to be an excellent sprinter, you have to work at sprinting. 8 hours a day, you have to lift weights, jump, whatever they do. And in order to be a magnificent cellist, you have to play the cello. You can't be running in the gym. So here's an example of two people, each of whom does something that they specialize in, and it means that they can't do something else as well as they otherwise would have done had they not specialized in the first thing. And everyone would accept that. Well, it's the same thing for women. Women specialize in housework and house cleaning and baby care and shopping and cooking and cleaning and stuff like that. So they'll do less well in other things, like in business. And the proof of this is that, this pay gap that women only make 70% of what men make. If you take never married women, women who've never been married, or lesbians, they don't make less than men. They make the same as men. On the other hand, if you take ever married women, women who are married, divorced, separated, widowed, whatever, they don't make 70% of what men make. They make like 40 or 50% of what men make, much, much less. So, and then there's other explanations like, women tend toward the pink collar ghetto because they don't want to have obsolescence of human capital. They tend to be nurses or, librarians or teaching second grade instead of being engineers or physicists, because engineering and physics changes. And that they're also more likely to be the trailing spouse. Like if the couple gets a good job in a new city, if it's the man, they'll take it. If not, if the woman, because they expect the woman is going to have babies and not be the primary caregiver. So we have a right to discriminate against women. And yet, paradoxically, it's not going to hurt them much or very little because of this magic of the marketplace.
But you're basically saying that if women just specialize as much as men, they will have the same wage, basically.
Yes, and the statistics bear that out. When you take never married women or women under the age of, 15 or 22 or something, where most of them are not married, they make the same amount as men because, again, in the 19th century and before, women were inferior in the productivity sense because they weren't as strong as men. But nowadays, 1% of jobs takes upper body strength? Maybe half.
Something like that.
So it really doesn't matter. And men and women are otherwise equal. So their productivity is roughly the same within a percentage or two of each other. And one of the proofs is the logical proof that I gave you about if a woman is being paid $15 an hour and she's equally productive to a man who's getting 20, her wage will rise. And the other is the statistics. Look, if we really believe in non-discrimination, we all have to be bisexuals. Why? Because homosexuals, whether male or female, rule out half the human race for love partners. Heterosexuals also are evil because they rule out half the human race. Only bisexuals don't rule out half the human race, so we should have compulsory bisexuality. But even the dirty, rotten bisexuals discriminate. They discriminate on the basis of beauty or a sense of humor or intelligence or whatever normal people discriminate on the basis of. So they should all be put in jail. Everyone should go to jail.
Everybody who's monogamous should go to jail.
That's right. Monogamy is evil because you're sticking to one person. What about the rest of the 7 billion people you're discriminating? You're disgusting, Klaus. I think you have a wedding ring and you're monogamous. He's despicable. We should put him in jail for discriminating. Namely, I'm trying to make a reductio ad absurdum here.
Yeah, you're quite good at it, too.
I have two questions I need to get in before we
finish. I have to toss Klaus in jail because he whipped me too much when he was my master.
You're getting back at me now. I see. So there's two questions I need to ask.
Sure.
I'll take the easy one first. Since you're a specialist in rent control, let's try your theory here. We have rent control in Sweden since World War II. Without knowing anything about Sweden, what is your prediction of the state of housing in Sweden?
Here is a book I didn't write, but I edited. And I've got quotes from two Swedish economists, which is a redundancy. And let me tell you what these Swedish economists say about rent control. Gunnar Myrdal won the Nobel Prize along with Hayek and a total commie.
Yep.
Says an important... Where is it? Oh, yeah. Rent control has in certain Western countries constituted maybe the worst example of poor planning by governments lacking courage and vision. That's Gunnar Myrdal. Another socialist Swedish economist, Assar Lindbeck, says, next to bombing, Rent control seems in many cases to be the most efficient technique so far known for destroying cities.
Right.
So what I did in this book is I have maybe 20 chapters from different authors, Hayek and a whole bunch of authors. And each chapter I illustrate with a picture. And either it's a picture of a rent-controlled city or a bombed-out city like Hiroshima, Nagasaki, or Dresden. And there's another picture. And each chapter has a picture. And I have a confession. I took the worst cases of rent control and the least damaging of bombing, because bombing is worse than rent control. And also I had to take out any picture that had Oriental architecture, you know, these curving roofs, or any Oriental people or black people, because that would indicate where they're from. And after I finished the book, I couldn't tell which city was which. I have it in the back as to which city is which, but rent control is an abomination. Rent control ruins housing, and the more strict it is, the worse housing, because landlords don't have any incentive to upgrade. People don't have any incentive to build new rent control buildings. So what they then do is they try to encourage people to build. And the way they encourage them to build is if a tenant moves out, then you can raise the rent. Well, now the landlord specializes in getting tenants to move out. And the way you get tenants to move out is by not repairing and by being a pain in the neck and all that. So rent control is just an abomination. Oh, by the way, thanks to rent control, I got my book, Defending the Undefendable. I told you that story. So what I would expect is ceteris paribus. Other things equal, if a place has rent control, the housing will be worse than it otherwise would have been. Now, if you get a very, very rich place like Sweden is a rich country, the housing isn't going to be so bad. But it'll be worse than it otherwise would have been without rent control. That would be my contention.
And it's hard to get a place to stay, too.
And you can't find apartments to rent in this country. Well, at least not in Stockholm.
At the prices people are allowed to charge, or at the rents people are allowed to charge.
No, it's just an abomination. They should get rid of rent control. It doesn't help. It's like a yellow light or a red light against investment in housing. They say that if you invest in residential units, that you're going to be regulated up the kazoo. But if you invest in commercial or other kind hotels, you're not going to be regulated. So money will go out of residential rental units, and it'll be very hard to find an apartment. There'll be shortages and chicanery, and prejudice will determine who the tenants are. Young, pretty women will get apartments. You guys and me will not get apartments, because most apartments are run by heterosexual men who like women more than other men.
Yeah, that's discrimination for you. Klaus, you had one more question.
Could you just – what is your view of the state of academia these days?
Oy vey. That's Yiddish. Oh, whoa. You have trigger warnings and safe spaces. And you know, if you say something that somebody doesn't like, they sue you, and then the dean or the college president. Oh, by the way, I told you about my problem with the New York Times, quoted me as favoring slavery. My college president, Father Wilds, S.J., and 17 of my fellow professors, when they read that in the New York Times, do you think they came to me and said, hey, Block, were you misquoted maybe? No. They just wrote in the student newspaper, Block is a disgrace. He favors slavery. You know, we should get rid of him. Happily, I have tenure, so it's hard to get rid of me. But, you know, I mean, the university is horrible doldrums. I mean, with this academic freedom is gone, and there was this case at Yale where some professors saying, you know, let's take it easy with regard to Halloween costumes or something, and you know, the students were outraged, and then you have all sorts of affirmative action, which really harms the so-called the beneficiaries of affirmative action, namely black students who, for one reason or another, don't do as well on average as white students. And Oriental students do even better than white students. And the poor Orientals are kept out of Harvard and Yale and Princeton because if they went just on the basis of, tests and ACT tests and SAT tests would be heavily Oriental. Similarly with Jews, the way they used to treat Jews in Harvard. Now, look, if it was a private university, they have a right to do this. But the point is that it really doesn't help black students. Say a black student who's at the 90th percentile in physics. Well, he goes to MIT where everyone's at the 99th percentile, and he leaves physics and takes up sociology or something, which is the only thing he can pass. Whereas he would have been perfectly good at some other school, like Loyola, which isn't a top school, or like Harvard or Princeton or Yale or any of those. But in other words, people are pushed up above their ability. Look, if we need affirmative action, you know, now they're complaining about affirmative action in, in Oscar movies. There weren't enough blacks winning. Well, why don't we have more equality in basketball? I mean, in basketball, I think the NBA, 80-85% of are black. Well, how about the gap between white and black basketball players? Why can't I become a professional basketball player? Just because I'm old and slow and fat. It's unfair.
What about tall and short? We need more short people in basketball.
Right. Slow, short, fat people like me. talking about reductio. So the university is in dire straits because a lot of the hippies and dippies from the 1970s, the lefty protesters who were protesting the Vietnam War, are now the deans and the college presidents, and they're running the place into the ground. On the other hand, with regard to public universities like Berkeley and Harvard and Yale and Princeton, I think that they shouldn't discriminate on the basis of education. Namely, the SAT test and the ACT test are discriminatory against stupid people. And if we upheld the rights of stupid people, the only universities that could still discriminate under a libertarian society would be Grove City and Hillsdale, and there's another place in Florida, which are really private universities. But all these places like Loyola and Harvard and University of California, they all get heavy government subsidies, so they're sort of not really private. Well, they shouldn't be allowed to discriminate on the basis of intelligence. Which would pretty much ruin them, that if they had to take people at random, that would serve them right.
Yeah. Taking government money is a death sentence in the long run.
Well, Ragnar Danishgold, the fictional hero of Atlas Shrugged, took government money. So we have to be cautious about that. It's okay to take government money if you're a libertarian, but just the Marxists shouldn't take government money.
Yeah, and you should be careful with what strings are attached to that money. That's true.
Thank you so much, Walter. It's been a true pleasure to talk to you. You can be found at walterblock.com, I believe.
Yes.
For those who want to dive into your work, you have a lot of your articles are available at mises.org as well. And people can, of course, buy your books. And we're going to finish as we usually do. Would you like to recommend a book? Absolutely any book in the world will go. We had Jeff Deist on, and he recommended the Flashman Papers. So any book, it doesn't have to be libertarian.
Well, you know, sometimes I joke around that I'm not really an anarchist, because I think the government should have one role, and that is to force everyone to read Man, Economy, and State and Human Action, and we should have taxes for that purpose. That's the only exception. So those are the two best books, and I would also toss in Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand and Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt.
Yeah, that one's been recommended, I think, twice already. So, all right, Man, Economy, and State by Murray Rothbard, Human Action by Ludwig von Mises, Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, and Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. You got four recommendations.
These two books are my homage to Henry Hazlitt, which was one of the two books that converted me to it. Henry Hazlitt had one principle and 30 chapters illustrating it. I have one principle and 30 chapters illustrating it too. So this
we'll throw in Defending the Undefendable, part 1, 2, and soon to be part 3.
That too.
Thanks again. Very nice to talk to you, Walter.
Hope we can have you back soon again.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it greatly and look forward to the next time we have a conversation.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.